Hi everyone, welcome and thank you for tuning in today. I hope you're doing well. Glad to have you with us. As always, this is Red Eyes Radio. I'm Henrik Palmgren from Sweden, and you are listening to independent internet radio dedicated to finding answers. RedEyesCreations.com and RedEyesMembers.com is our websites where you can follow us on a regular basis. We feature news, radio, videos, analysis, and a whole lot more. Today we are talking with Vietnam Special Forces Air Combat Controller and 25-year CIA deep cover agent Chip Tatum. He was a U.S. Army pilot flying classified missions during the U.S. invasion of Grenada and an Iran-Contra pilot flying undercover arms and cocaine shipments for the Enterprise. Also a member of the ultra-secret international G7 Run Pegasus hit team. We are going to talk about his story today. And joining us as well is, if you're a regular listener, one of our previous guests, Ulla Dammegård. We've talked about the assassination of Swedish Prime Minister Olof Palme with Ulla before. He's also the author of Coup d'etat in slow motion about that same subject. He's here with us to fill in a few blanks and also ask some questions as we listen to the story and testimony of Chip and connect some of the dots with Ulla's research as well. Interesting discussion ahead. Chip Tatum, welcome and thank you for coming on the program. Great talking with you today. Hope you're doing well.
Thank you.
Excellent. And we have, of course, Ulla Dammegård, returning guest with us as well. Welcome back, Ulla. Nice to talk with you again. Everything good on your end?
Yeah, I'm very blessed. Thank you. It's great to be back.
Excellent, excellent. This is going to be very interesting convergence, I guess, in the things that both of you have been speaking about now for quite a while, specifically that of Pegasus. And this is something that we'll discuss, obviously, in more detail later. But Chip, I thought we could kind of begin with you, obviously, and set the framework a little bit. Maybe you can tell us, I guess, your story, really, Chip, as it's long and it's involved in that regard. But please feel free to be as detailed as you need to kind of set the framework a little bit for our audience that might not be familiar with you and what you've your past, Chip.
Oh, well, right. And for their edification, I began my government service as a young man of 19 years in 1960. Latter 1969, going into 1970, I joined the Air Force, hoping to become an air traffic controller and work in air traffic control later in life, receiving that training. I was promised that even if I did go to Vietnam, and that was during the Vietnam years, I would be in an air-conditioned control tower hundreds of miles away from the action. So that really, that was my ideal situation. Right after air traffic control school, the top 10% of our class was sent to learn how to parachute. And that was pretty cool, too. I thought that was great. And then after parachute school, they sent us to jungle survival school. Now, things weren't going so great for me at that point. And I asked the technical instructor, that's what we have in the Air Force, what's going on? How come we're going to these if we're going to be going working in a control tower? And he said, you think you're going to work in a control tower? He said, you're crazy. We're forming a new group. They're called combat controllers. Well, what is a combat controller, Tech Sergeant? Well, son, a combat controller puts a parachute and a radio on, jumps out of an airplane between the friendly and our boys, and calls in the airstrikes. And I said, alone? He said, oh, no, we're going to send someone with you because you're going to have cryptographic codes with you, and if you're to be captured, it's his job to make sure that you aren't taken alive. So that was the beginning of my government service, and I became a combat controller and was subsequently sent to Vietnam and to Thailand. I was in missions there, classified missions, what people would call false flag mission, where called Operation Red Rock, where the United States had U.S. military personnel dressed in Viet Cong uniforms attack the air base or the Air Force base in Phnom Penh in Cambodia, posing as Viet Cong in hopes that we could get Lon Nol, the president, to come to the United States and say, please help us. I think we see a little bit of that going on possibly elsewhere in the world right now. Who knows? Unfortunately, because of the classification and the security of the mission, we weren't destined to be picked up. So 15 to 20 kilometers outside of Phnom Penh, there was an attempt on our life by the people who were transporting us. Fortunately, they failed, and we survived. About 2 weeks of combat, we kept running out of ammunition, as you can only carry so much with you on a mission, and we were subsequently captured. We stayed in, as the government puts it, you weren't prisoner of wars, you were detained, because we were detained by the host country, and we weren't in combat. Two of us walked out of that encampment alive. In my debriefing in Clark Air Force Base in the hospital, I was wounded. The man who called the mission and the man who briefed the mission along with General Haig, name was Colby. He was called Ambassador Colby at the time, but he was the station chief for the CIA in Southeast Asia. He later became director of CIA. At that point, he told me that the president feels very confident that if you're held close, you'll keep his secret. And for that reason, he offered me to go to work directly for the CIA or under the control of the CIA and stay in the Air Force. And after that little instance, I didn't want to stay under the control of the CIA for anything in the world. So I chose to work for the Air Force from there on. And our missions and my direct control was under the Defense Intelligence Agency. All of my orders, everything that I received, assignments, was through them, and I would report on a weekly basis back to them as to what was going on in the different areas that I was posted. That took me through 1978. After 1978, Bill Colby had become director of the CIA, and he was leaving in 1978, and the position was being turned over to a man named Bush. And Colby came to me and he said, "Now listen, you really want to get out of this. I'm going to let you go. Nixon's out of office. Everything's pretty copacetic with things. So we're going to give you a leash and let you go. And I'd advise you to take it, because this man coming in isn't anyone to be toyed with." And he was speaking of George Herbert Walker Bush, the incoming director of the CIA. So I did. I did exactly what he suggested. I got out and I went to Gunnison, Colorado. Started a family, opened a little deli shop, as any great spy would do, and was very comfortable skiing most of the time and opening the deli shop whenever I wanted. It was right in Crested Butte, Colorado, in a university town. Unfortunately, a few months later, some guys in suits and sunglasses walked in and said, "Mr. Tatum." I said, "Yes." They said, "Uncle Sam wants you again." I said, "What do you mean?" They said, "Well, you're being reactivated and you're being sent to the United States Army to learn how to fly helicopters." So I was reactivated. I was sent to Fort Rucker, Alabama, for flight training for helicopters. From there, we were sent, and let me say, in that training, they had chosen a number of special operations personnel, ex-CIA, ex-special forces, to go through helicopter training because they were forming a new unit. It was called Task Force 160 at the time because it wasn't a full unit. Once activated, it was the 160th Aviation Battalion, which is the Night Stalkers. Those of you listening today would know the Night Stalkers as there were the pilots who flew the aircraft that went into the Bin Laden compound and crashed.
Oh, right.
That was us. We called ourselves Night Stalkers because we practiced under night vision goggles. Everything we flew was night vision goggles. Only because to fly the missions that we flew in a helicopter, they fly low and they fly slow. And to avoid any enemy contact, we'd have to stay under radar and have the cover of night. And so that's how we practiced and that's how we flew. With the Night Stalkers, I was involved in the Grenada invasion and several other missions, which ended up taking me to a little place called Honduras in the 80s. In Honduras, we were flying, posing as medical helicopters because the Boland Act that came out in the early 80s would not allow for the United States to provide to the Contras, Nicaraguan Contras, any type of logistical or military offensive support. only humanitarian support. So they took the special operations guys, put them in medevac helicopters, and had us flying Hueys with a big Red Cross on the side. We were flying medical equipment, arms, and intelligence personnel posing as doctors and medics into these Contra camps, and flying medical supplies in big white coolers out. We did that for months. Every time we'd come out of a camp, we'd take at least 10 of these coolers with us. One time we had a hard landing and a cooler fell out of the door, busted open, and we found that it was over 100 kilos of cocaine in that cooler. So when I got back to Operations Center, I called Washington Switch and talked to my boss. His name was Oliver North, and told him what I found. And he said, "Tatum, don't you worry about that. That's fruits of the war. We're going to take that, and that's going to be used as what's the evidence again in the world courts against the Nicaraguans."
Right.
So, and that was my initial contact within the Iran-Contra affair, and as that was in the early, I guess, before 85, around 85, 86, I left military service and went into non-uniform service, working for the same people, just without a uniform, with more levity. And we would fly various kinds of aircraft and various kinds of missions around the world in support of the National Security Council and with the same group of bosses until I left in 1992, at which time I was told that you don't just walk away. And I said, "Watch this." And I walked out, and I'll be darned if a couple weeks later they didn't come knocking on my door and arrest me for treason. I was charged with treason, and later that charge was dropped, and they went through tax records. They went through anything they could go through to try to find something wrong. And finally, we came to the agreement that if they'd leave my wife alone and my children alone, I'd say I did something wrong, make up something, and I'll go attest to it in front of a judge. And so they did. And I did my little term in prison, and that's all behind me.
When was that? In the prison, was that late 80s, early 90s or something then?
That was the late 90s.
Late 90s, okay.
The late 90s, yes. I left in 92, and we fought back and forth until around 95, and then I had to do 25 months in federal prison and got out around 97.
Oh.
Can I just say that was, at that time, many of the people like myself who had been following Chip thought that you disappeared for good, because you went out live making interviews, or the former FBI chief Gunderson, Ted Gunderson, made interviews with you, and then after that you suddenly just disappeared, and we really, really feared that you and both you and Nancy had been taken out. But then 10 years later, boof, here you are again.
Right. Well, I was living in Florida when I was released from federal prison, and doggone it, if George Bush's son didn't want to run for governor. And so they invited me to leave Florida, and I took them up on it. So I went to South America, and I stayed down there for about 9 years, 10 years, and came back 2 years ago. Still with the same knowledge, and I wasn't convinced that anything I had to say would really have relevance today, until a good friend had convinced me. She said, "You know, what you had to say then has probably more relevance today, because while you were gone, more people were able to hear the message and can take that and look at what's happening today and see a lot of relevance in that." So I've come back, and I am speaking, and they are aware I'm speaking. They've come and visited a couple times.
Now, can you
let them visit?
Well, exactly. Well, the question there is, how can you speak about some of the missions freely in the way you do? I mean, is that one of the reasons also why you partially went to a prison, do you think, that you were outspoken about all of this?
Well, during during my term with the government, and just before, I guess about 2 years before Director Colby left office, he said, you need to be thinking about insurance. So I started collecting insurance. I started collecting documents that were given to us, flight plans, maps, flight maps, audio recordings. You know, working for who we worked for, we had access to all the best equipment in the world at the time. So I would make audio recordings, video recordings, and I just keep it tucked away as my insurance policy. So that I didn't just disappear and become fish bait. So right. I had those, and when I left in 92, I gave them a copy of what I had. And that's what the controversy was about with them. They wanted me to turn those documents over or face treason. And I said, I'd rather face treason than turn those documents over, because turning those documents over is my death sentence. Mm-hmm. So I didn't. And while I was in the federal court system, there's a action called the Classified Information Procedures Act. And in that act, it's if a defendant in any federal case wants to use classified information in his defense, he may ask permission. The courts have to hear and go through that and decide whether it's classified or not. So I presented everything I had to the courts, not everything, but a lot of it to the courts in my defense. I said, I want to use this in my behalf as testimony, and I want to call these 87 witnesses. And the judge looked at it, and if he had decided that, yes, it's classified, then he would have had to close the doors to the court, get the U.S. Attorney's Office to provide the clerk, and everyone in the courtroom had to have top secret clearance because of the level of the information that I had and was proposing, including himself. All the witnesses would have to go through security clearances, and it would be years in the making. So instead of allowing me that, he said, this is what I'm going to decide. I'm going to decide your information is not classified. That gives me the right to talk about it.
Oh.
Now, however, he went beyond that and he said, but you cannot use it in your defense.
Okay, but you can do interviews like this and talk about it, no problem then.
I can talk about anything that I turned into him. Now, there are things that I didn't turn into him and I don't talk about, not for 25 years. And that's coming up in a few years. So.
All right. Well, that's interesting in itself. So just remind us again then, Chip, when kind of along the way did you have a change of heart and in regards to the kind of missions that you were involved in and what you did?
Well, you know, when you first go into the military, they say you're yum, dumb and full of, but you're very patriotic. You want to be there. You're thinking that everything you're doing is in defense of your country and that you're making things better for your family and loved ones back home. And you're actually defending the Constitution and making the world better. But once you start moving through the ranks and once you start working in these missions, you start seeing what's really happening. Now, as long as you're staying low in rank and not moving up through the ranks and being able to start tying these missions together and seeing where things aren't quite adding up. 3 + 3 really isn't adding up to 6 here. What's going on? Then you start feeling that something's wrong. And so you start looking a little deeper or you just close your eyes to it. I'm not one that can close my eyes to things. So I started looking deeper. I started evaluating what we were doing. I started questioning other commanders, like myself, about their missions, because we were very compartmentalized, and we started comparing notes. And there are several of us in various parts of the world who were in more or less the same position. They didn't get charged with treason, but they are themselves still hiding out in fear of their lives. And I hope to come out and do this and perhaps help them in being able to come out and be free from that tyranny.
Yeah, that's what it would take, I guess, as well, right? To just more and more people speaking out about what really is going on. Now, was there a reason why they picked you for these missions? Were you just particularly good at what you were doing and your training and such? Or was there any other reason, do you think?
I was very good at what I did. Some people I've been on the radio with have talked about being able to get out of particular situations when the government went after them. And I just told them, well, be glad they didn't send me after you. You wouldn't be on the radio today.
Well, that's encouraging.
You're next, Henrik.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I wish I was that important, but there we go.
Can I just say that the first version of my book, Coup d'etat in slow motion, in that the last final chapter that really hadn't really any connection to the rest of the book directly was the Tatum Chronicles written by David Guyatt. Exactly Chip's whole story, his whole background, all these different missions, and also because it was such powerful information to get it from the inside. And that's why I think it's incredible, both the courage you're showing Chip and also the way that you show other people that are in the process of becoming whistleblowers, and so that it is possible to come out with this type of information, and also the importance for the world to be able to see this from the inside and see what's going on, so that we can get a better understanding. And once the transparency is there, then on the other side, we can start healing it. So I really salute you as a man and as a soldier and as for what you're doing today, including your wife as well.
Well, I'm sure she appreciates to hear that also. Coming forward as a whistleblower, if any of you are thinking about doing it, it's not easy. And you have to plan it. You can't just one day say, oh, the heck with it. You should plan it, because you have to know that the first thing that's going to happen is they're going to try to place you in a bad light, as bad a light as they can. And that's the way they do it. They'll try to neutralize you by talking about digging up any dirt on you that they can find, even taking statements from family members and turning those, twisting those. Even though it's not what a family member or friend may have said, they'll twist that and they'll spin that to what they need to do. They want to deface you as quickly as they can, so that what you have to say is nothing more than a disgruntled employee or something like that. So be prepared and make sure you collect your data. And it's not just words, but you have something to back those up. We had flight plans, we had audios, we have all kinds of things. And even with that, major media wouldn't touch it.
Now, is a lot of that material available on your website, Chip?
Yes, some of it is, and the flight plans are downloadable from my website called the Tatum Chronicles.
Right, very good. Now, by the way, are there any other recommendations you have? I mean, in terms of just having your story straight and knowing what you're doing, and if you are to speak out as a whistleblower, is there any other recommendations that you have?
No, just have everything ready. Have your finances ready. I would say get your, if they're going to go after you hard and try to arrest you, you need to understand that they're going to take all of your funds. They're going to seize your funds and then put you at the mercy of the federal government if you're in the United States, so that you have to use a federally paid defender who is paid by the federal government, so they're not going to do anything in your behalf to speak of. So you need to try to get all your ducks in order, get all your finances in order before you do that.
But don't you think there's a greater risk than just being attacked like that? I would say a more physical danger to this whole thing as well.
There is that side, and we see many of them just disappear. Absolutely. Look at the gentleman who just moved to Russia. He had to leave fast, so.
Interesting that they're going to Russia, isn't it? I mean, the world has changed in the last few years. Wow. Now, there are so many aspects, of course, to what we want to talk more about here, Chip and Ulla as well, about, you know, where your work, you know, kind of connects and everything. And as you said, Ulla, you've been following Chip's work for a long time there. But, I mean, the Iran-Contra affair, Pegasus as well, as a separate issue, but still kind of connected in with all of this. It's very much Iran in this time when you were doing this kind of stuff, Chip. And I mean, the drug shipment of you know, the U.S. of shipping in drugs into America and everything else. What are some of the more, I mean, how have you pieced together this puzzle, if you will? And what are some of the more, I guess, highlights, for the lack of a better word, that you think that our audience should know about of what kind of activity has been going on?
Well, you know, in the years before Mr. Bush became the director of the CIA, things were really pretty calm for me. We had little missions. I had a small mission going into Yugoslavia, posing as a Mormon missionary to see, try to gain information about Tito at the time because it was thought he was sick, and if he was sick, who would be his replacement? Just small missions like that, nothing real dangerous. But after Mr. Bush came into office as the director and then as vice president and then as president, everything had changed. I mean, everything had changed at that point. The missions became more dangerous, more aggressive. The things that we would see being done with black operations were more toward funding. If an operation didn't have something to gain out of it as far as funds go, it wasn't called, it was given somewhere else. So for us in the Pegasus group and in Black Ops and in the OSGs, it all became a huge business proposition, like I guess along the lines of what they call corporate spying and corporate intervention. That's if there wasn't anything in it as far as funds or protecting their errors, like in the Palmy instance, then it wasn't done. It was turned over to other entities.
Now, just a quick question about that. Would you say that this was primarily going into the pockets of those who were involved, or did this go to fund something else?
Billions of dollars into black operations. And I would assume those monies funded future operations and lifestyles and everything else for them. Yes.
Yeah. You want to say something, Ulla?
No, I just wanted to say that I've been in touch with some people that from the inside have said that the name the CIA, the Central Intelligence Agency, is an agency for hire, that it's corporate. Anyone who needs their services can hire them. Would that be a correct way of seeing it?
There are entities that the CIA used to be the young guys out of university. Now they're mercenaries. They work in all kinds of different areas, and when they're released from the CIA, they're picked up by these now it goes into privatization, is where everything's run out of, and they're picked up as mercenaries and all for profit. That's correct.
But the primary funding, except of course the black budget, as we talked about, mentioned a little bit, is still from government sources, though, correct? So the people and the taxpayers are funding the operations.
I don't think the people have to pay for black operations any longer. I think those accounts are so fat.
They're paying for themselves, and yeah. Well, there are some speculations. I don't know if necessarily you want to go there, Chip, but that a lot of the black the budgets, if you will, has gone into development of some really extraordinary technological achievements. Of course, not only spy technology and all this kind of stuff, but you know what has led to today, what we have, drones and everything else, and perhaps even more exotic, if you will, that we haven't yet really seen in the official world. Is that anything that you could confirm or speculate on?
Well just seeing the level of technology in aviation that we have, if we had some of the things that we had back then when I was flying, I wouldn't have to worry about flying under radar. I could flip a switch and be off of radar. Taking over aircraft, you see the movies where they had to get control of Air Force One, they had to try and put men on wires going from one aircraft to the other or going up through a hatch. Not any longer. Everything's fly-by-wire, and it's I had pulled up just recently a classified patent by Boeing that shows how it would be possible to mitigate someone hacking into the flight control system with a telephone. So they're aware of the abilities of writing a program to take over the control services, flight controls of an aircraft with a simple smartphone. Yeah, they're aware of it.
So any comments on the latest 370 issue here?
I continue saying the same thing, no debris field, no crash.
Yeah.
And that aircraft doesn't fly itself.
Can I just say one thing also, that I haven't been looking into this affair with this plane so much, but very often when there's something major going on in another area, there's these diversion operations carried out so that the whole media, everyone will be looking in the other direction. And at this very time, on March 31st, there's an open court, a people's court in Brussels, that has subpoenaed Queen Elizabeth II and the former Pope and other people in high positions accused for child genocide. This is a major, major thing, accusation against the global elite. And I think this might be, we were waiting to see what would pop up that would try and divert the attention from this thing. And then this plane came up and everybody's looking there and nobody's have even heard about this court case that is being carried out while we're speaking.
Yeah,
sure. And those diversions only aren't only in that. Those diversions, just like the diversion of this crash, if it is somewhere else, they're being diverted to an area where it probably isn't, where it you know, I see the diversion just within that operation itself, not wanting the media to go look around the world for where that aircraft might really be. They're diverting them down to the south. The Chinese diverted them with false fields of debris, and now the Australians are diverting with false pings. You know, look, those pings only work for 2 miles, and now they're saying they're 13 miles apart. I'd say it's a fast swimming dolphin with a collar on.
So it's also indication that it's a cooperation, perhaps between a couple of different countries here.
Several different countries.
Yeah.
You know, then there are military operations between those same countries going on as we speak in that same zone, and when the aircraft went missing also.
Yeah.
Chip, can I ask you something? When we're talking about airplanes and different crafts and so on, when it comes to chemtrails, we are being bombarded here in southern Spain with these silver-colored planes without no signals being sent out and just going up and down, up and down, up and down, covering the sky, or as they call it, cloudy, partly clouded, with all these white stripes. Are these planes flown by pilots, or are they drones, or what is it? Do you know, is that something you have any knowledge about?
Well, back in the old days, we did a lot of cloud seeding, and it took it wasn't done. A lot of people think that, you know, it just put in the fuel pods and it runs through the engines and out, but that's not the way it's done. It's actual atomizers that atomize the chemicals into the air and drop into the clouds, or it's physical larger particles that are dumped into the clouds. A lot of chemtrails are just that, are chemtrails, but a lot of them are honestly just regular trails from the aircraft, with the leaving the at that level it's coming out as ice. But I would say that they're flown by pilots.
Okay.
Yeah,
and there should be some out there ready to talk. Even if they're not flown with pilots on board, there's pilots somewhere flying those.
Yeah. No, I tell you, it's since we got such a blue, wonderful sky here, it's so obvious when you see the normal planes and you see the other ones. I mean, it's day and night, and these they just continue. They start around 7 o'clock in the morning. They come with 12 minutes in interval, and they go parallel stripes up, 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 and up, and then within a few hours, the whole sky is just one white cloud, poisonous cloud that is just spreading around. And then when they carry out for like 2, 3, 4 days, after that we get an interval with cold and damp weather, very much like that. I've got sources that can also supply satellite images of these, and it's very, very different from the normal planes to these. So they're definitely here, that I know for sure.
Uh-huh. All be right. Interesting to find out where they're flying out of, huh?
We've been trying to make out sort of like a network to see where they come from, because they come from the Malacca direction and they go towards the south of Portugal, and then they turn around and they go inland about like 10, 15 kilometers inland. You see them going the other direction, and then they just go up and down, up and down, up and down. Normally for about 5, 6 hours, sometimes at night as well. And sometimes you can see different colors, you know, it's almost like there's like a composite that two planes follow each other One has a gray something that they spray out, and the other one light green. And sometimes we get these very, very odd rainbow effects in the clouds. You know, not real rainbows, but the clouds goes into rainbow colors. And
one of the chemicals we would use to spray was like aluminum oxide, so that might be,
Yeah, that's definitely in there.
We found aluminum, barium, strontium, arsenic, these type of things. So not very pleasant.
Interesting. Ooh. Now, let's definitely keep that in mind, gentlemen, if you want to return to this. I don't mean to cut off too much, but I wanted to talk a little bit about Pegasus as well, the connection between both of your work here, basically, and how this ties in with the assassination of Swedish Prime Minister Olof Palme, and then kind of go out from there and look at the bigger picture of Iran-Contra, the drug trade and all the weapons and everything else. And there's a number of other people, of course, that connected some of the dots as well. We had, for example, I'm sure you know Gary Webb, right, Chip? Were you accustomed to his work?
I provided him some of the information that he used in his article.
Yes. Well, there you go. Yeah, exactly. And he was, of course, taken care of, I believe. I don't want to speak too much, but that's what it feels like to me anyway.
Suicided.
Yeah, yeah. Now, Pegasus, what was that? What is that if it's still something that's active, running?
The group Pegasus in the early years was in the 50s was formed to basically spy on the spies. In other words, they reported directly to the president, and their job was to go out and look at the different spy entities that were out there and keep an eye on them to make sure that they weren't violating their constitution by coming in and spying on government entities, the president, and congressional entities, and trying to blackmail them into whatever their wants and desires were. So that was the original Pegasus, and after years it evolved into still working directly for under the president, but in various other operations. And in Pegasus I was directed by the operational subgroups and the National Security Council. So we would receive our taskings as the commanders, and we had assets we could pull. We could pull in Delta Force SEALs or Defense Intelligence Agency assets to perform the missions. Each of those missions, the assets were paid $50,000 each, cash. I would normally go to the bank, a particular bank that was set up here in the United States. Just pull out $250,000 for a particular mission from a line of credit, the open line of credit we had, and that would be replaced the following day. So if we needed more, it was there. We would pull off missions, intimidation. We would sneak people in under radar into several different countries. We would pull people out of countries. The missions really varied. They were across the board. For the Pegasus and OSG group.
Now, were you involved in anything directly with when it came to Olof Palme?
No, not directly with Olof, but I am aware of the problems that resulted over McFarlane, Secord, and North's attempt to purchase weapons to get, I think, missiles or something, from what I recall it was, from Bofors and other weapons from Bofors. Unfortunately, they couldn't get end-user certificates, and they approached Palme, because Bofors was a Swedish company, approached Palme to provide those end-user certificates. Palme said, not only no, but heck no, and I'm going to put your names into the international courts, and from there on, I can only assume that they had to take care of business.
Wow. Yeah, exactly. Comments on that, Ulla?
No, do you know that it was only a week? There's only a week between when they killed Barry Seals in Baton Rouge and when they took out Olof Palme?
Yes, I am.
And I think there was if you look chronologically, blah, I'm not English, you can see that it's almost like there's a cleanup team that started around Barry Seals and that started to clean out and going down in West Germany, Sweden, many of these different countries, the states as well, trying to clean up, to shut the whole thing down or shut it up.
And in that same time, yeah. Right, Ole, and in that same time period you're talking about, we have, before going into testimony and being called into testimonies before the federal courts, we have Mossad officers being offed. We have an ex-director of the CIA being taken out. Several. I mean, just like you said, it's within weeks. It was a whole international cleanup, a global cleanup.
Would you mind naming these people you just mentioned?
One was named Amir Amnir, was a Mossad officer who was...
He was shot down in a plane, yeah.
Right. He was tasked. He was assigned to North and to the be the interface for the Mossad and Israel in the operations. Israel was supplying a lot of the arms, and so he was their interface. Bill Casey, the day before having to testify, he went in for voluntary surgery and died on the operating table. Voluntary surgery now.
What does that mean, voluntary surgery?
He volunteered to let them cut into his head. Well, I mean, it wasn't required at the time. It wasn't, they didn't feel that it was life-threatening. And so that's why it was voluntary surgery. It was threatening. It was a cancer. It was threatening, but not life-threatening. And he died on the operating table.
I tell you, when you get into these areas, I just fear hospitals more and more, especially when you go under anesthetics, because there's so many that don't come out on the other side.
And, you know, a doctor holds a lot of power in his hand in what he can report. You can go all the way back to JFK and come forward to see what they report and what they don't report and what happens to those medical professionals afterwards, too, you know, so that they can't acquiesce and go back to another story. Many of them, in time, are just taken out.
Do you know, one of my friends in Sweden, he was the central point of what was called the privatspanarna, like the private investigators, normal, honest people that were just very concerned about what had happened with the Palme assassination and the whole twist of society that happened afterwards, very concerned. And I was part of this group. And the gathering force of this group, his name was Fritz G. Pettersson, he went in for a checkup and came out with very violent cancer that killed him, like, boom, short. First, it went on his speech center and so on, so he couldn't really communicate anymore. And then he died very shortly after.
Yeah. Well, you know, one thing that was never brought out, and during the Iran-Contra investigations, it was always thought, what's missing here? They're still keeping something from us. And it wasn't just the drugs that they were keeping from us, because a lot of people had already heard about that. But what they were keeping from them was the sale to Iran of yellow cake uranium, U-308. Tons of it farmed out of Namibia, I believe, in South Africa, a mine that was controlled by a British company. And tons of it were shipped out of there in the agreement for the release of hostages and for the working with them in other areas to Iran. And the person who caught wind of this was a good friend of Olof Palme's, a man named Brent Carlson.
And Brent Carlson,
right.
And he intended on going to the courts and United Nations. Well, he was a United Nations ambassador in Namibia. It was his effort, and I know he had to have talked to his good friend Olof Palme about this. They were trusted friends, and he ended up dying, and with all the not all, but with a lot of the evidence in a briefcase,
in the Lockerbie,
in a briefcase on the Lockerbie crash.
Yeah.
And the CIA hurried in there, and that briefcase was never found.
And I tell you, just a few days before he died, he told his girlfriend that he was one of four or five people that knew the real truth about the assassination of Olof Palme.
Mm-hmm.
Let me ask you this: Why did they want to provide yellow cake uranium to Iran? Is it kind of like arming the enemy type of scenario here, or?
Well, the United States actually built the reactors for Iran and gave them weapons grade uranium initially when the Shah was there, and they had yellow cake and they had everything there to run their test programs and their research programs to the research reactor that we built for them in the 70s. But it only has so long of a shelf life. And when that shelf life, when the use goes down, then they have to acquire more. And when the Ayatollah came in, he didn't feel that uranium and this type of energy was what Allah wanted. And so he took the program and just slowed it down. He didn't nix it completely, just slowed it down. But then after a while, he was convinced that the program really needed to go forward because they really needed this research. And so he acquiesced, and the negotiations, you know, we hear about the negotiations in trading arms for the hostages with Iran. Iranians didn't need arms. They were already getting all that they wanted from Israel. Israel was sending all kinds of arms, and so was South Africa. They didn't need arms. They needed that yellow cake uranium.
Well, and also if they built, sorry, Ule, if they built some of the infrastructure nuclear-wise, that might speak a little bit about the Stuxnet hacking as well, if they're, you know, they know about the infrastructure of the system down there, right?
And what's interesting in all of the attacks that Israel did on Iran, on their nuclear facilities, they never did attack the nuclear facility the U.S. built for them.
Ah. Huh.
It remained intact.
Interesting. Yeah, Ule, you wanted to chime in there?
No, I just wanted to say, Chip, could you explain a little about this struggle that was about around getting the hostages back? Because it was being delayed on purpose as far as for quite a long time because of this struggle about the presidential election.
The election, the outgoing president, Jimmy Carter, and I forget what year that was, so long ago. But Carter was the outgoing president. The candidates coming in were Reagan, and I forget who was running against him. I just can't recall. But it was the Israelis came to, at the time there were 50-something hostages being held in Iran. And the Israelis came to the United States and said, listen, if you negotiate with Iran and offer them arms, we'll supply the arms for them. And you can tell them that not to allow those hostages to be released until after the swearing-in ceremony. And so it was called the October Surprise. I'm trying to get this right, recalling so many years back in the 80s. The plan was that when Reagan took his oath of office, within minutes, the hostages were all released. So
he became the big hero for the whole thing, even though he had
big
been
hero for
delaying
those,
it for.
For those hostages, however, within months, new hostages were taken.
That's funny. So, what do you make of the propaganda film Argo about the, you know, the, was some articles on this too, the Great Escape and whatnot, right? That they faked a movie and all that to get the hostages out. Did you ever see that?
No, I did not, but I think I did hear something about that. Yes.
Right. Right. Yeah, there was a kind of a little bit of a fuss around that a couple of years ago here when it came out that movie. Nonetheless,
I mean, if you look at the whole setup of it, there's like four letters that could explain it. One of them is CRAP, and the other one starts with S. It's so Hollywood based, pumping up the whole aggression towards Iran, I would say, even though it's based on real events.
Right. Yeah.
And well, can spin anything, and that's the thing. Yeah. That's what they did.
Chip, could I ask you now, when I've got you here, could I ask you another question? How was the relationship between Reagan and Bush, and the assassination on Reagan? Was that a how should I say, a sort of like an inside coup from Reagan, or was it a whole, was it just a big setup or a black op, or how do you explain that situation when Reagan was shot, if he was shot?
Well, Reagan was holding the reins pretty tight in his first term. And then Vice President Bush needed more room to be able to work. Let me say that whatever happened to Reagan with those 22 shot with the shots from the 22 wasn't life-threatening, but it was life-turning for him. And so he realized at that time he couldn't keep a tight hold on what he needed to keep a hold on. And so the first time in history, and the first time in the United States history, the oversight of intelligence in the United States was passed from the President of the United States to the Vice President. And it remained in Bush's hands to run all of run everything offshore and onshore and intelligence. And as far as State Department and other entities, he was handling all that from that point on.
Yeah.
Sounds a
First
bit like
time, first time and last time that I'm aware of in the history of the U.S.
sounds a bit like mission accomplished.
Sounds like it to me. Good operation.
Yeah.
Now, gentlemen, let's take a short break here, and then we'll pick up here in just a few minutes. But we want to give out some details to both of the websites that you have and plug them, so make sure that our audience know where to go to find out more. You're writing regularly now, I guess, Chip, not only on your own website, chiptatum.com, but also over on Veterans Today, correct?
Yes, and as a matter of fact, next Monday we start our own Veterans Today radio show that I'm hosting, and I'll have both Veterans Today writers and other guests on board. It's a 2-hour from 6 to 8 every Monday night.
All right, great. VeteransToday.com. That's the website for that. ShipTatum.com. Is there anything else you want to talk about in terms of your website, what you have on there for people, Chip?
Folks, we also have WikiArmy.com. If you have anything you want to write about, it's an open website. You can go in, sign in, and write your own article, post it right there. We're not going to edit it. We're not going to take it away, take it offline. But we do ask that you not be vulgar and not hammer on other people. As a little personal, don't use it as a personal vendetta. Use it as an informative information site.
All right, very good. We'll have those linked up on redicecreations.com as well. Ulla, let's do the same for you, of course. We want to plug your book as well that we've been talking about so many times, our series that we've done and everything. So please give us the details.
My website is lightonconspiracies.com. My book is, one of them is called Coup d'etat in Slow Motion. It's about the Palme assassination, but with all the different connections globally to this assassination, because if people think it was a Swedish assassination, they make a major mistake. It is so into tangle with these all other global events. Also, I write on Veterans Today from time to time, and I would just like to say, if anyone would like to help with donations or signing up for newsletters or something like that, that is incredibly appreciated, especially lately since I've been part of exposing two serial killers, two of the worst serial killers in modern history. And after that, everything has been shut down on my website. It's been totally messed up. So any kind of help is greatly appreciated.
All right, there you go. Definitely, if you want to help out Ulla, go over to the website lightonconspiracies.com. We'll have that linked up as well. All right, gentlemen, we'll take a short break here. We'll be right back. Very interesting conversation, and we'll pick this up right after the break. So we'll be back with more.